Hi, Dave Emery here. This is Side 2, For the Record, program number 820. Interview with Ed Haslam about Ebola and the new edition of Dr. Mary's Monkey. This is being recorded on November 16th of the year 2014. Once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to present Ed Haslam, the author of Dr. Mary's Monkey, the successor volume to Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. We have been covering Ed's ongoing investigation since 1996. Ed, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Before the break, we were talking about a fellow named Juan Valdez, and you mentioned a timeline that linked his apparent burglary of Mary Sherman's apartment with Dr. Martin Luther King's famous I Have a Dream speech, the March on Washington, and also the trip to Clinton, Louisiana by Lee Harvey Oswald and Clay Shaw. We talked about that in other interviews that you and I have done, and also in the interview with Bill Davey, the author of Let Justice Be Done. We should perhaps mention that the milieu, my favorite word, that links Lee Harvey Oswald to David Ferry and Alton Ochsner and the anti-Castro Cuban effort, goes through Guy Bannister's office in New Orleans. And Guy Bannister and many of the people around him were also, in addition to anti-Castro activists and intelligence operatives of one kind or another, they were very active against the civil rights movement, which many reactionaries saw as part of the, quote, international communist conspiracy. And there are many links between the killing of Martin Luther King and that of President Kennedy and his brother Robert. So in that timeline that you gave, Ed, there is much food for thought and grounds for further research of the number of different topics. One of the things that I found most exciting about the new information in your second edition was a fellow named Chauncey Holt, H-O-L-T. Tell us about him and what you found out about his relationship to the individuals, institutions, and events in this book.
Well, Chauncey is a very interesting guy. His main political affiliation was he worked for Meyer Lansky, the mafia boss who ran the gambling operations in Havana. Chauncey was a pilot. He was an weapons expert. He was an accountant who knew how to embezzle and cook books, and therefore he could watch over Lansky's empire and look at all the books and spot people who were trying to steal from Lansky. So Chauncey is, I mean, he was Meyer Lansky's right-hand man, and he would fly Lansky around and all this other stuff. Then when the CIA came to the mob and said, we want to set up this Operation Mongoose, which would be untraceable to us so that we can do things that we're not allowed to do legally, they set up Operation Mongoose in a building in Los Angeles, and Chauncey Holt was right at the center of it because he was one of their main artists in charge of forging documents and stuff like that. And Chauncey winds up coming down to New Orleans in August of 1963. They had some gun-running operations. They were going to distribute the guns through, quote, the distributor, who, according to Chauncey, was Guy Bannister. And we find Chauncey being photographed coming out of the International Trademark Building at the exact moment that Lee Oswald is standing out in front handing out his Fair Play for Cuba committee pictures. And Chauncey says, that's me in the photo, you know, and he shows a photo. Now, what's really interesting to me is when you listen to Chauncey talk about that event on the video that he does, he says that he was in the International Trademark Building for a meeting with Lloyd Cobb, who is the founder of the International Trademark and was Clay Shaw's boss. So we have a meeting going on between Meyer Lansky's right-hand man, pilot, bodyguard, and accountant, with Clay Shaw's boss going on in the building while Lee Oswald is standing out in front handing out Fair Play for Cuba committee leaflets, and the whole thing is being filmed.
And I should mention that the Information Council of the Americas, run by Ed Butler, and the famous interviews that Oswald did on WDSU with Carlos Bringier and Bill Stuckey and others, grew directly out of that leafleting that Oswald was doing in front of the International Trade Mart.
And Chauncey says that when he was in town, Lee was arrested on August 9th, and he goes over to the courthouse, and he goes and sits with Lee in the bleachers, you know, waiting for him to be called up. And he's sitting there talking to Lee. Now, this is interesting because this is a member of Operation Mongoose who's got one foot in the CIA and one foot in the mob, and there he is seeking out Lee Oswald. And you say, Chauncey, why are you doing this? And he said, I couldn't figure out why they were giving this guy all this attention that they were giving him. Something was up with this guy. They were setting him up for something. Okay? And so, to me, Chauncey's book, which is called Self-Portrait of a Scoundrel, and his videos, which you can find, there are links to them on my website, drmurraysmonkey.com, are all just other pieces of the puzzle. You also find, and I found this out from talking to people who knew Chauncey, that he was flying around monkeys, okay? And he actually has correspondence with the guy that developed that Antivin antibiotic that we were talking about in another show. In his, you know, they found a locker in his attic that had a 700-page manuscript, which is what Self-Portrait's based on. So I think Chauncey's a real player here. I do think he was one of the three tramps. You know, he looked like a tramp because he was raised in the circus and knew how to do that stuff. And Chauncey's a very interesting figure here.
By the way, we should mention that many of the people in this drama or Janus faced, although they are they belong to the intelligence community and to the efforts against Castro. People like David Ferry, for example, with obvious links to intelligence, also worked for Carlos Marcello, a capo mafioso for New Orleans, who also was tight with Bannister. And you we've spoken in the past about Dutch Muret, who I believe was Oswald's uncle, who also had links to the mob and had been able to help Lee with various things in the past. And there's a guy, too, that a name with which I was not familiar that I'd like to discuss with you, Ed. And that is a guy named Stanley Stumpf. And if you would tell us about him and how does he figure into the new information that you've developed?
Well, a friend of mine was talking to a doctor out of Ochsner about, and he raised the Mary Sherman murder subject, and the doctor said, well, everybody knows that Stanley Stumpf killed Mary Sherman. And I'm thinking, everybody? Like the homicide detectives?
Except for the FBI.
And the homicide detectives, and PD homicide detectives, okay? Because I read everything in the file, and I didn't find anything mentioning Stanley. So I said, well, who is this guy, and all that stuff, and it turns out Stanley was, he had gone to Tulane University. He was quite a successful athlete. He lettered 3 years in a row in both basketball and baseball. And he got into medical school. He was from a prominent family in New Orleans. He got into medical school, and he became Mary Sherman's orthopedic resident. And so he saw Mary Sherman on a regular basis, you know, day in, day out, working for her out at Ochsner's Hospital. He also worked in the emergency room down there. And what was interesting, I mean, one of the stories that started coming around about Stanley was that on the night that Mary Sherman died, Stanley was, you know, you work in an emergency room, you basically work 24 on, 24 off, and you never show up on your day off. Well, on his day off, he shows up. And he doesn't talk to anybody. He just shows up and goes in the back and gets something and leaves. And everybody says, that's kind of strange, you know. And then I find out that I hear these rumors that Stanley kills himself, okay? And I hear that's a couple of months after Mary Sherman's murder, and that's great. You got dead and, you know, crazy and all this stuff all in the same package. Anyway, I get on the radio in New Orleans and say, you know, if anybody knows Stanley, would you contact the station and let me talk to you? And I find out that Stanley dies. He does have a drug problem, and he's about to have his medical license pulled. And he lives across the street from this guy who's talking to me. And Stanley dies 13 and a half years after Mary Sherman dies. which I find kind of interesting, because if, quote, the rumor mill, everybody knows that Stanley killed Mary Sherman, how come for 13 and a half years nobody said anything?
And if I'm correct, that also would have been while the House Select Committee was reopening the investigation, although perhaps that word belongs in quotes, of President Kennedy's assassination.
It's also when Dr. Alton Ochsner Sr. was still alive. And my concern is that in order to protect Stanley, you had to have some real muscle. And Ochsner had that kind of muscle. So was Ochsner protecting Stanley because Stanley actually knew something and was part of this? And what did he do at that night at the emergency room? I think he went in the back and got a body bag, because that's where you keep body bags, in the back of the ER. Okay, because when people die, you got to have a body bag for them. Okay, and he takes the body bag down the street to the U.S. Public Health Service, which is only about a mile from there. They put Mary in the body bag. They take her back to her apartment, but Mary's 136 pounds of dead weight, and she lives on the second floor. And somebody's got to pick her up out of the back of the car and carry her up the flight of stairs and stuff. And so, and somebody's got to open the door for them and all that stuff. And they find these women's gloves there with bloodstains on them. And that's not, Stanley, you know, the basketball player, is obviously not wearing the little women's gloves. You know, so there's a couple of people involved in this, in relocating Mary's body back to her apartment. And maybe Stanley is part of that. That doesn't mean he murdered Mary, but it does mean he was part of the covering up of the thing. But he did it with complete amnesty. He was bulletproof, because, and that's why nobody ever did anything about it in 13 and a half years.
One of the things that is new in your book, Ed, are crime scene photos of Dr. Mary Sherman's murder. And I wonder if you would go into that and what that signifies, because what we were told, that she was killed by a burglar, and then there's some intimations of some sort of rapist or something like that, that is at fundamental variance with the actual forensic evidence about the enormous physiological damage that produced her death.
Well, there's an old saying that says a picture's worth a thousand words, and we've got 10 pictures here. So the point is that what was described in the autopsy report is shown very clearly in these photos, and that is Mary Sherman's entire right arm, right shoulder, right rib cage, all the way down to her hip bone was disintegrated by heat. Now, if you know anything about bones, you realize they don't burn. Okay, it takes thousands and thousands and thousands of degrees to vaporize them. Okay, and immediately next to this burn is her unburned hair. So how do you get, and it's perfectly obvious in the photo, how do you get this unburned hair next to this carbonized, disintegrated bone? Okay, and that is the evidence of a high voltage electrocution. And when you focus on that point, you will realize there is absolutely nothing in Mary Sherman's apartment that could have possibly done that, nor is there any evidence of that much heat existing in her apartment, because you look at the photos of the room, and the curtains next to her bed are there, the book sitting on the nightstand is there and not burned, the carpet underneath the bed is not burned. I mean, there's just no evidence, and nobody even reported seeing a flame. Okay, so what we have is a faked murder scene. And what's interesting to me about this is this faked murder scene was never properly investigated. In fact, the real crime scene was not even her apartment. It was over at the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital, and that was never investigated. And then we get these really, really, really bizarre things going on, like later that day, right, on Tuesday, July 21st is when they find her, right? Later that day, LBJ, who's president at the time, he decides to make an unscheduled meeting stop at the Pentagon on his way to Arlington Cemetery, where he goes and stands at Jack Kennedy's grave for the first time since the assassination. All right, so there's a lot of this weird stuff going on the same day that really makes you wonder, how high does this go? Who had to make the phone calls and say, you guys are not going to talk about this? You know, because they never told the public her arm was missing. They talked all about her being naked and the stab wounds and everything else, but nobody ever said her arm was disintegrated because they didn't want people going around uptown New Orleans looking for a machine that could burn off her arm.
Indeed. So they did not want to say farewell to arm, so to speak. And obviously, again, underscoring the point that Ed made, and this was made in our previous interviews, it would have taken heat exponentially greater than anything that could be reasonably found in a home fire to burn off Mary's arm and part of her rib cage, and yet other things that were far more flammable and disintegratable, to coin a term, like her hair, carpet curtains, her books, and so forth, were not burned. And if, in fact, a fire of that tremendous heat had taken place in the apartment, there would have been conduction of the heat, and many other things would have burst into flame. So this simply does not compute. As we track forward into the present, Ed, I think before we get to one of the fascinating and relatively recently developed items in your new book, The Redaction of the Family Jewel, number one, you write about something in your new edition with which I was not familiar, and that is a link between antibiotic use and the outbreak of polio. I wonder if you would stretch out on that one for us.
Okay, antibiotics goes back to World War I, and Alexander Fleming was a frontline doctor working for the British Army, and he was very frustrated by what he saw on the front lines because he had people, his patients, dying left and right around him, and they were killing as many of them with their treatments as they were just losing them to infections. So after the war, Fleming gets interested in how does the body fight off infections. And quite accidentally, he winds up with a piece of a sandwich in a petri dish, and the mold from the sandwich kills the bacteria. And he writes a paper on this and saying, there's a pony in here somewhere. You know, there's a possibility that we might be able to produce medicine out of this. But he doesn't know how to do it. And about 12 years later, the British, some British scientists resurrect his paper and said, you know, we want to try this. And so they go out to Oxford, and in the next couple of years, they figure out how to make a medicine out of this mold, penicillin, that Fleming had discovered. And Britain is going back into a war, going into World War II there, and they now know how to do this, and they want to ramp it up, but Germany is bombing them, okay? So this is not a good time to build a new factory. So they turn to the Americans and say, look, we got the science. We need you to build a factory. And so in 1942, the Americans come online with large quantities of penicillin. I mean, they basically said, let's use the model of like a beer factory, you know, with big vats and all that stuff, to develop this in large scale because we're going to need a lot of it because we're going into a major war. And so when I realized that that was done in 42 and that antibiotics were released in 42 all over America into clinical medicine, I was very interested to discover that the polio epidemic started in 1943, the following year. I mean, when you look at the numbers, and I have them in the book, they go all the way back to 1900, et cetera. There's basically about 3,000 or 4,000 cases of polio a year. In 42, there's 4,000 cases. In 43, it jumps to over 10,000 and continues to climb up to over 50,000 cases in the 50s, which is what we call the polio epidemic. And it occurred to me, I mean, you got a quid pro quo there. I mean, this is a question it's a reasonable question. I've never heard anybody ask it. Is there a connection between the introduction of antibiotics and the onset of the polio epidemic? And I think it's very reasonable to say there may be, and I actually proposed in the book a mechanism which I describe, and I've presented to medical groups and stuff and have gotten very positive feedback on it, which basically says that the polio virus normally passes through the body without causing disease. It goes in the mouth, out the bottom, and nobody gets any disease because it never gets in the bloodstream. But if you start doing stuff that messes with the intestinal flora in there, and you start compromising the integrity of the intestines, then the stuff in the intestine starts to get in the bloodstream, and that's how the poliovirus gets into the blood, which is why we had an epidemic. And the position of the drug companies there, I mean, their options are few. They either pull back on the use of antibiotics or they push for a vaccine. And so I think that's how we got this well-financed hysteria over the polio vaccine, was the drug companies did not want to pull back on antibiotics. And, you know, I'm a big fan of antibiotics when they're used properly. But they were in the position of restricting them to, you know, syphilis, gonorrhea, those kind of things, instead of having them part of pop culture medicine, which is what they became.
Yes, and we should mention in passing, and again, there will be so many elements of this discussion that will be perhaps puzzling to new listeners. We have an extensive body of information developing this in Ed's books, the three editions, basically beginning with Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, and in our many discussions and in the descriptions for these, looming very large in the sequence of events that you have investigated, Ed, is the polio vaccine itself and a contaminating monkey virus called SV40. Very quickly, and maybe that's not possible, but before we go in to the redacting of Family Jewel number one, if you could just fill us in on the polyoma SV40 and the contamination of the virus, and perhaps if you can do so synoptically, the doctors / Mrs. Eddie Stewart and Sherman.
Okay, well, they were in a great big hurry to develop this vaccine, and the fastest way they could develop it was to grow the polio virus on monkey kidney cells. And when they took out the polio virus to make the vaccine, they got all the other viruses that were in the monkey kidney cells, including SV40, which was a polyoma virus that caused cancer. And they didn't fully realize the dimensions of this until they had already released 100 million doses, and they still had 100 million on the shelf. And what they did was mass inoculate the American public, particularly children, with a cancer-causing virus, which, in my opinion, is why we have an epidemic of cancer today in America.
Oh, very quickly, and again, perhaps I'm asking too much, but another devastating disease of the worldwide epidemic proportions also figures in your investigation, and we've talked about this extensively in past interviews, and that is AIDS. Can you perhaps encapsulate that for us?
Well, quickly, the ancestor virus to AIDS is SIV, the simian immunodeficiency virus. It was in the polio vaccine with SV40, and in this effort in New Orleans to mutate SV40 into a benign strain that they could use for developing a vaccine to try to stop the current cancer epidemic. They started exposing it to radiation, and my concern is the gamma ray radiation they were using was quite capable of mutating the RNA of the simian immune deficiency virus. And that is a reasonable scientific explanation of how SIV could have mutated into HIV-1 with the assistance of gamma ray radiation. And that's a balloon I float in the book.
And so if people are wondering perhaps why so many of these events have been deliberately covered up, it's not just the JFK assassination, although that would certainly be plenty, but we're talking about epidemics, including AIDS, polio, and who knows how far back some of these investigations overlap Ebola. Ed, you also write about the redaction. Well, first of all, the, quote, CIA family jewels, unquote, and the release of these and the ostensible move toward transparency. And yet you write of what was done with family jewel number one, or perhaps what wasn't done with it. Tie that in with the other things that we have spoken about here, if you would.
Well, a question I get frequently is, did the CIA itself as an organization really know about this biological weapon program? Okay. And that question would be easier to answer if we knew what the CIA did. Okay. So during the Watergate situation, the new director of the CIA started shooting off his mouth in front of the press and was saying things that weren't true. And his staff said, hey, boss, you know, there's some stuff you need to know. And he commissioned a internal review of things that the CIA did that was either illegal or embarrassing to the CIA. And this internal eyes-only document was referred to as the Family Jewels. That's the CIA's name for the document. And then it was, you know, buried for many, many years. And then in 2007, the year I came out with Dr. Murray's Monkey, General Michael Hayden, who was the director of the CIA at the time, held this, time to open the kimono press conference about the Family Jewels. And what was interesting was he had the list of all eight Family Jewels and the several pages on pawn each. And what I found interesting as I went through them was that you could see what jewel 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 were, but jewel number 1 was 100% redacted. And the time frame of this memo is exactly the time frame of Dr. Murray's Monkey. And so there's something that the CIA did 50 years ago that was so egregious that 50 years later they are not willing to tell the American people a single word. I mean, that's nothing from the summary and nothing from the three pages of text. Not an if, and, but, or anything.
And this covering the years 59 through 64, am I correct?
Yeah, maybe, 58, 59 through 64.
And again, that is more than a half century ago. And once again, it reminds me of Bugs Bunny in the haunted house. He knocks on the door and says, anybody in there? No, there's nobody in here. You know, it's just... I don't think you have to be Sherlock Holmes to figure out that there's something very suspicious and conspicuous in that omission. Ed, we are down to our last 2 or 3 minutes. Is there anything that you would like to include in the, by way of concluding remarks before we once again tell people where they can go to get your book?
Well, I'm speaking next week in the Dallas-Fort Worth area at a JFK conference, which is free and open to the public. And if you want information on that, you can go to jfkconference.com. That's the immediate thing. On my website and blog, I have maybe 15 hours of videos about the background to all this stuff. So if you really want to know where all this is coming from and you're willing to take the time to watch it, it's all there. Just go to drmarysmonkey.com, and that's about it.
And again, for listeners who would like, Mary Sherman, one of the threads that ties this all up is Judith Vary Baker's working relationship with Lee Harvey Oswald and the development of cancer as a biological warfare weapon, very possibly to use against Fidel Castro in Cuba. Ed, where can people get your book?
They can get it at any bookstore. They may have to order it. You can get it on Amazon, of course. There's an 800 number if you're an 800 number person. That's 800-556-2012. That's 800-556-2012. And that's about it. I mean, it's out there everywhere. This is not a hard to find book. You just have to look for it.
Very good. So as gift giving season comes up, you might want to think about putting Dr. Murray's Monkey under your tree or in stocking. And as Dave Emery's 17th principle says, much better to have Dr. Murray's Monkey under a tree or in a stocking than on your back. So this, basically, I hope that has whet people's appetite for Dr. Murray's Monkey, the new edition by the heroic, and I hope I'm not embarrassing you by calling that you that, Ed, Ed Haslam. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 820, interview with Ed Haslam about Ebola and the second edition of Dr. Murray's Monkey. This has been recorded on November 16th of the year 2014. For Ed Haslam, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.